You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's program,
the United States of America strongly supports NATO and will be unwavering in our commitment to this transatlantic alliance.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence affirms his country's commitment to NATO, but confirms that his boss wasn't kidding about other members of the alliance paying their way. My guests Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patalano will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the limits of free speech as one especially tiresome tester of the boundaries appears to have found them, China's suspension of coal imports from North Korea, does Pyongyang now have any friends left, and
we had a very smooth rollout of the travel ban, but we had a bad court. We got a bad decision. That's the only thing that was wrong with the travel ban.
Indications that tourists are realizing that the world is a big place full of countries more hospitable than Donald Trump's America. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. My guests today, those are two terrible words to put together, and yet we keep doing it. Alessio Patalano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. First of all, let's have a listen to this.
The United States of America strongly supports NATO and will be unwavering in our commitment to this transatlantic alliance. The promise to share the burden of our defense has gone unfulfilled for too many, for too long, and it erodes the very foundation of our alliance. When even one ally fails to do their part, it undermines our ability to come to each other's aid. At that Wales summit in 2014, all 28 members of NATO declared their intention to move towards a minimum security commitment of 2% of their gross domestic product on defense within the decade. Let me be clear on this point. The President of the United States expects our allies to keep their word, to fulfill this commitment, and for most, that means the time has come to do more.
Well, not for the last time, one senses. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence finds himself clarifying the remarks of his boss to an audience of nervous allies. The other 27 members of NATO may be comforted by Pence's affirmation of the United States' commitment to the alliance, but they have also learned that President Donald Trump is not the only senior U.S. official who believes that the rest of NATO is failing to pull its weight. Alessio, first of all, at issue here, of course, is that 2014 guideline which specifies 2% of GDP. Only five countries meet it. The US, the UK, Poland, Estonia, and rather surprisingly, Greece. How have the other 23 that leaves us with? Yes, it does. 28 minus 5 is 23. How have they been getting away with it?
Well, I think there's a number of different reasons. You can, I think we can look at this from two different points of view, from two different perspectives. One is the circumstances. So even though they pledged to keep at 2%, national conditions and the sense of not imminent sort of a security threat, shall we say, it politically made it very difficult for governments to remain in power if they actually had committed to that 2%. In practical sense, there are a few ways in which these numbers you can play around. You know, you can play with some of the numbers depending on how you calculate pensions, research and development. So those that are closer to that 2%, I suppose that the ultimate answer to your question is they got away because politically they said we're getting there, but the conditions are not ripe to do it now. But at the same time, they had the opportunity to play around a little bit with numbers by the simple nature of how you actually calculate calculate that 2%? How does that translate into sort of defense budget capabilities, manpower, research and development? So you've got a door, if you want, that goes wide open. But I think at the heart of the issue, the problem is that NATO is, as a security alliance, as a military alliance, has at its heart this idea of Article 5 responding to coming to the aid of one of the members when it is attacked. And the problem is the very simple major threat that NATO is facing, by NATO's own admission, that is Russia, is a failing state with a GDP that is much less than only two of the larger European economies, with projections that are terrible. Therefore, politically, it's very difficult within NATO European members to find a justification to uphold that promise of 2%.
Sebastian, one of the recurring themes of Donald Trump's ascent has been whinging that America is being taken advantage of by the rest of the world. On this particular specific instance, does he have a point? Is it unfair that the rest of Europe allows the United States to pick up its national defense tab?
Well, I mean, I take all of Alessio's points, but to be honest, if people sit around the conference table in Wales in 2014, and Cameron, back then the British Prime Minister, says, well, let's commit to 2%, and everybody nods. Well, then, guys, you've got to cough up. Mm. I mean, to be fair, the plan is over 10 years. Mm. So we're now in 2017. It's meant to be fulfilled by 2024. So there is time. And some countries, of course, I hasten to add Germany amongst them, have started to spend more. But by the way, can I also add that the International Institute for Strategic Studies last week came out with a calculation which said the UK does not fulfill the 2%. It's just under. I mean, it's ridiculous, 1.98, but it's under. So anyway, that's what to Alessio's point about how you calculate it. Every military expert, I think, will tell you that it isn't about 2%, because of course your GDP contracts, and then suddenly you've got far too much, and the other way around. What is much more important and hasn't been done over the last 15 years, ever since the peace dividend from the end of the Cold War, that NATO members and EU members, quite a lot of them are, of course, both members of both organizations, haven't made the step to more coordination, cooperation, buying stuff together, thereby spending money better. That I think that's at least as important as spending 2% of GDP.
I mean, Alessio, even if everybody's not quite spending 2%, the amount being spent by the 28 member states of NATO is a fantastic sum of money. After all that spending, are there areas in which NATO is woefully deficient?
Right. Now, that's a very difficult question to answer. Let me put it differently. Let's look at the latest, sort of the last operation that NATO put together, even though admittedly at the beginning was a NATO-French operation. And we're talking about Libya. If we look at Libya, the one thing we know is that unless the United States had intervened in the very early stages, the first 72 hours, to clear out air defences in Libya with the Marine Corps, had not American submarines fired about 170 out of the 220, it was called as a US-UK, but basically UK launched less than a fifth of the overall Tomahawk that were used in contribution of knocking off air defences. And even if we look at sort of individual countries' commitments across the world, most notably France in Africa, they're doing a lot. But for example, without air refueling from the United States, they wouldn't be able to run the operations in Mali. Here, what I'm talking about is that in the peace dividend that Sebastian mentioned, we forgot that in order to run military operations of a certain complexity, you need a certain military machine. And we got used to the fact that if we're missing something out, we can just knock at the American door and say, like, sorry, can we borrow that for a second? And I think that's the fundamental problem. And it goes back to the question of how you manage that 2%. And I think examples that happen across the spectrum. So back to your question, it's a lot that we're spending. Yes, although since 2012, Western Europe has been lagging behind, for example, to other regions like the broader East Asia, whereby they are on an average of a 3 percentage point of aggregate spending higher than Europe, and that gap is widening every year. But also in Europe, what is happening is that individually different countries, if they were to pool resources together, would be much more substantial than they are, but we're not just doing that, because there is an identity crisis that is political and first of all needs to address what exactly is NATO supposed to do, just wait and see it, or actually go out there and Bureau of Security Provider, which was the logic behind most of the strategic documents that came out towards the first sort of 10 years or 2000s.
But we haven't got a problem seeing who our adversary is in Europe. You know, look at it in geopolitical terms. The Americans are clearly, and quite rightly, I think, worried about China. Mm. Now, so they want to spend much more of their military capacity. They want to use it in the Pacific and want to leave Europe much more to the Europeans. Mm. And I mean, we have a country on our doorstep which has annexed a part of its neighbor, namely Russia, the Crimea, and is waging a war in eastern Ukraine. So you know, there are clear deficiencies. I mean, in cyber war, I think we are lagging pretty much behind. Isn't that right? Against the Russians. Also, the way they have these militias that they have, where they deny for weeks on end that it's actually their troops. All of that kind of capacity isn't there.
Okay, well, let's move along now to consider one of the more irritating ironies of our age, which is the fact that the noisiest advocates of free speech are almost invariably those who have the least of interest to say. Prominent among these has been the tedious provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, who, having made an inexplicably lucrative career of being an obnoxious jackass, now finds himself abruptly dropped by his publisher and disinvited from conferences for being slightly too obnoxious a jackass. While he may need not, rather, detain us further, the debate over what one can say and where is likely to persist. Alessio, first of all, inevitably, Milo's many fans are claiming that CPAC rescinding his invitation, Simon & Schuster dropping his book, censorship, which is... It's an argument which in situations like this always annoys me, because it isn't. No one's stopping him from saying anything he wants to. He just can't say it at this particular conference, and he can't have it published by this particular company.
Absolutely. I think free speech comes with the degree of responsibility. If you don't want to live up to that responsibility, then, you know, others will decide. You know, freedom starts and ends where someone else's freedom begins, in a way. So I think it's finding that kind of balance and understanding that kind of balance. Besides, as an academic, I find it... I just do not understand the phenomenon, as in there is nothing articulated, there is no idea, there is a shouting and contesting most of the time. So what's free about that? You know, if you're just shouting, I'm here to listen. Freedom is about also sharing with others. What is there to share? There is no articulated substance to it other than presenting what reality is not. It's a negative message, and it's a negative message that is delivered without any sense of responsibility. So it fails in what should be one of the principal elements that in the US Constitution, for example, is protected, right? This idea that with freedom comes a degree of responsibility, because we're a community, we all come together.
Not really anything in the First Amendment about degree of responsibility. No. I mean, the delineation, at least as it seems to me, I think, you know, that Mr. Yiannopoulos, and indeed anybody else, has the perfect right to say what he likes. But it's the assumption that he and his fans have that they have the perfect right to say this absolutely anywhere. I mean, Sebastian, the analogy that always strikes me is that if Twitter or any other social media platform were a bar or a restaurant, and somebody came into that bar and started picking fights and being obnoxious, then you'd throw them out.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be abrogating their freedom of speech. It would just be saying to them, you're going to have to make that free speech on the footpath and not in here. Do social media companies, and Twitter has in this particular instance banned him previously, but do social media platforms have to take a greater stand in imposing some standards, do you think?
I certainly think so. I mean, we've got a very interesting thing going on in Germany about Facebook. Facebook basically ignores those who spread the Holocaust denial, which is in fact under German law forbidden. Mm. Now, let's, you know, we can argue till the cows come home whether or not you should have that kind of law. But maybe in my own country, it's understandable. And yeah. It's the law of the land. And yeah. Facebook refuses to actually fulfill that law of the land.
But then the cross argument to that, of course, there are many countries where Facebook operates which have much more restrictive and much more, you know, oppressive freedom of speech laws, and Facebook is a way of circumventing them.
Sure.
Although, if I go back to your metaphor, I think there are very few places where you can actually go and have a fist fight and happily and express your freedom. And that's because, as I said, I think there is an element whereby we should not forget that freedom of speech is not just throwing out anything that is coming across your mind. Is also doing so by minding your surroundings, because you are part of a society, you're part of a community. You cannot sort of take yourself out of the equations. In other words, I think here is not the question of freedom, but it's how you deliver your thoughts and ideas. You can have your views, but I think how they are expressed, and fundamentally about the element that connects all of this is a sense of anger, anxiety, violence. That is not acceptable, whether it is social media, Facebook, or a bar or anywhere else, really.
But it strikes me as strange, Sebastian. I'm just wondering where it comes from, because it's a recurring trope that you get creatures like a Yiannopoulos who are creations of the social media age. They become extraordinarily popular. They have a vast audience, a huge following, and they keep complaining that they're being suppressed.
I'm afraid I can't help you with that paradox. I mean, isn't that the problem that we saw in the U.S. elections? And you know, I to be honest, this is serious. We have a increasing divide between people of different opinions, and there is not enough shared space in the middle anymore, where people agree on certain rules and agree that certain facts are facts. Mm. I mean, if we agree that
certain manners need to be observed.
If we now have a U.S. president who just throws out something about Sweden, which, you know, exactly. totally picked up from some television broadcast, which he clearly misunderstood, and then people seriously afterwards don't say, well, he made a mistake, but they say, well, of course, the nasty others have actually neglected to tell us about all the terror attacks in Sweden, and then you start wondering about their ability to share a state, a democratic forum with others who aren't of their opinion.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Alessio Patalano and Sebastian Borger. Coming up, the alternatives to holidaying in the US if Trump's travel ban has put you off. Do stay tuned.
How would you fix London's dining scene? How would you make the capital even better a food destination? For the latest on our series of live broadcasts from Midori House, me, Margus Hippi, and Monocle's food and travel editor Josh Fennett will be joined by a host of experts. They include restaurant critic and columnist Grace Dent and restaurateur Martin Morales. That is The Menu this Friday, the 24th of February at 1900 London time. Get your ticket today at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patalano. Now, North Korea has been in the news this past week for reasons picturesque even by its standards. The bizarre assassination in Kuala Lumpur Airport of Kim Jong-un's half-brother Kim Jong-nam. Away from the lurid headlines, however, a potentially more significant story. China announcing that it will cease importing North Korean coal. Now, Alessio, coal, if I've got this right, is North Korea's main export, and China is North Korea's biggest trading partner. So this is pretty bad for North Korea, isn't it?
It is. So the first thing one should say is that in the context of the United Nations, China is generally speaking a relatively silent member of the Security Council. But if there's one issue where they speak out, they're fairly consistent, is in regards to North Korea and North Korean behavior, especially when resolutions are crafted. So this comes after a degree of pressure put on China, as in, well, if you are such an important economic partner, you could impose stronger, so you could implement the sanctions more strongly as to discipline their behavior. Now, this is certainly true, and I think that the fact that this came over the weekend, a bit like a bolt out of the blue, explains the fact that the Chinese felt their pressure and they needed to do something. But at the same time, I think it is very important, it's a very important reminder of the complex issue that the Chinese are facing. Because on the one hand, like many others, they don't want the North Koreans too unstable or too destabilized, but at the same time, they want to try to sort of help the rest of the world to get them back to a negotiating table. And I think at one level, the problem is to this dilemma that the Chinese have at the moment. How do we get a situation where the North Koreans will be slightly more sort of opening to a discussion? On the other hand, I think it's also very symptomatic of a bigger problem that China has at the moment, and that is, since the passing away of Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, they lost a tremendous amount of political leverage in North Korea, partly because
why,
of the purges.
Why is that? I've read that before. Why is that, Alessio?
Oh, because Kim Jong-un basically started sort of clear the deck of all his father's sort of supporters and allies. So, and also, you must understand, Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il had been brought up very closely to China. They had lots of friends, personal connections, political connections. This is certainly not the case from Kim Jong-un, who was kept away from the country. So he didn't go grow through the ranks. So he has not nearly the same connections. He has not developed them. And he got rid of all the people who had that connection.
But the facts remain the same, as Andrew pointed out. I mean, if you don't allow them to, North Korea to export the coal anymore, well, there's very little left apart from grass and atomic weapons that they can export, is there?
Well, that is certainly true, but they do have a pretty solid variety of businesses that they run. So they
black market, you mean?
Black market, but you know, there's
they export weapons. There's that weird chain of theme restaurants, isn't there, that the staff keep defecting from periodically?
Yes, there's also that. I mean, to be honest, the North Korea, of course, if you've got a certain amount of defectors, it makes it easier to keep the other people alive because you've got less left mouths to feed. But on the more important point, they are very active in some financial markets. They're also very active in black markets, weapons export, arms exports. And even though the system has become particularly sophisticated in trying to track down all the various sort of fake companies that they put together and the various sort of different locations where they place their business, still, that's enough to keep the regime going.
I just wonder, I mean, Alessio is the expert, and I just throw it in. I just wonder whether if China wanted to topple the guy, it would happen. They don't, because they want him there, because it's great fun for them to have a constant irritant. For the last 25 years, we've been talking about this. Subsequent U.S. administrations have invested lots of money and negotiation time in trying to find a solution, and no solution has been forthcoming. In fact, North Korea has developed its atomic bomb and is now developing an intercontinental missile. We are looking on while China, that's just my impression, keeps it as a bargaining tool, basically.
Well, finally tonight, reasons possibly to sell whatever shares in US tourism you may still own. Analysis of data from several companies by the New York Times suggests a dramatic tapering of interest in visiting the United States since the swearing in of President Donald Trump and his attempt to disbar the citizens of seven largely Muslim countries. It appears that the citizens of other countries are taking the hint. I'll ask you both, Alessio, you first. Are you less likely to go to America on holiday than you would have been this time 3 months ago?
So I must confess that I just landed back from the United States yesterday.
Sell out.
Sorry. And I actually was flying like 3 weeks ago. So I arrived in the US when the ban was still on. at JFK, and it was quite remarkable because it wasn't very late, and for an international airport, it was
JFK is always a shambles, though.
It's always, but it was deserted. You know, there were a few people.
Really?
Yes. So that was the interesting thing. And I must admit, also, as I was coming back yesterday, there weren't that many people around who took the flight, and the airport was largely empty when I was there. So either it's a very, very well diluted sort of airport, or already
it's never been my experience of JFK. Yeah. No,
perfect. So something is actually happening, because in the experience of this past few weeks, I was quite surprised at the difference. But I have to go back in a couple of weeks' time. So I that won't change. But it's mostly academic. Would I go for vacation? Probably not to DC or the sort of main political places, just because there's so much out there. And of course, when the atmosphere is not quite right, I think on the one hand, the atmosphere is not quite right. So if one wants to make a statement, I suppose that makes sense. But on the other, one should not sort of put the burden on all the Americans on the back of what a single American president is doing.
What about you, Sebastian? I mean, it's probably easier for us as, you know, as three white men, but I have spoken to, well, it is, because I've spoken to friends of mine who hold European passports, but who may be of Pakistani or Indian or Iranian heritage, and they've started to think, you know what, I'm really not sure it's worth it.
Well, and totally understandable. Why should you go for that kind of thing? I have to say, I've just last weekend inquired at a travel agent about a trip I want to take with my 16-year-old to the West Coast. Well, the West Coast, of course, voted for Hillary, so that's okay. But no, come on. I mean, as you say, it's easy for us. It's presumably quite tough for people of different colours.
I mean, I've had issues before going into the States. They've always been very polite about it, but I have some fairly picturesque stamps in my passport, which have got me held up a few times. But Alessio, when you start to hear stories of people being asked for their social media accounts and their phone IDs and stuff, would that sort of... If you start having to think, well, I can't take my laptop, I can't take my phone, do you just think, well, sod it, I'll go to Canada?
No, absolutely. But I'll tell you something more. I think this is a very serious question that sort of triples down past just the 10 days vacation or whatever. I mean, I've heard of a number of prospective students who are now looking at Canada as an alternative to the United States, not only because it's slightly more affordable, but also because it's got the same very similar standards in terms of some of the universities. It's much more welcoming.
And a healthcare system, less likelihood of getting shot while you're at the shopping mall, that kind of thing.
Exactly, that too. Plus, you can, you know, pay back the system by staying in Canada and work for a few years, whereas in the United States at the moment is becoming increasingly more difficult. So there's all sorts of issues at the moment that might very well have an impact on turning the United States less in that sort of beacon of a dream of making a new life than it used to be, which would be a very, very sad thing.
I mean, Sebastian, it's not going to bankrupt America or its tourist business in 4 years, obviously, but is it possible that this will make enough of a dent that people notice?
Well, if this statistic is borne out over the next few weeks, it's a 17% drop. I mean, people will notice that, there's no doubt about it. And of course, the dollar is comparatively strong at the moment. So let's see how his economic reforms work out. That will have at least as big an impact. But of course, that will impact on the tourism industry.
And just finally and briefly, once from each of you, if not the United States, where would you recommend people wavering on the subject go on their holidays instead? You're not allowed to say Germany and Italy.
Can't I say Italy?
Yeah, you can say Italy.
And I can say,
Alessio can say Germany.
No, I recommend Japan, actually, and Tokyo before 2020, because a lot has been done, and the city is now bursting with life. But before 2020, there will be lots of the benefits without the 2020 chaos.
And I'll add Australia, Andrew. How is that?
Well, thank you. That saves me from having to do it. And I will recommend enthusiastically both Germany and Italy. Italy. Sebastian Borger and Alessio Patalano, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Geriat. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next at 1900 at Section D. I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.